Great, thank you very much. So I'm currently the laboratory director of a USDA laboratory in France. This is the only laboratory outside the country, and we focus on classical biological control. And we're very much interested in expanding our cooperation and collaboration with people. So if you're interested in that, please see me later. Classical biological control, that is the use of alien insects or pathogens to control invasive plants, has a long history in North America. And this is a classical, one of the first big successes back in 1940. And the strategy of biological control is to find some agents that can bring an invasive plant, such as St. John's wort, the yellow color here, under control. This field had once been all yellow, and the insects were released over here and started defoliating the plants. And the control continues today. It doesn't kill all of the plants, doesn't eradicate the plants, but it simply reduces them to a level that's acceptable. And this is the ideal objective of classical biological control. It doesn't work on all target weeds, obviously. There's a very select classification of weeds that are susceptible to this. We only target alien species. It's important that those species don't have any close relatives so that we can find agents that are specific enough to not harm other species. Yeah, but I think I'm supposed to use this so that, well, anyway, for recording. And typically, this is the tool of last resort. If you can't control it with eradication or herbicides or other management strategies, then people start to think about biological control. Certainly, it isn't a panacea, and often it's integrated with other management strategies. Just to give you a perspective, this is just a snapshot from California of how successful is this. Well, over the years, 36 species of weeds have been targeted. 65 species of agents, mainly insects, have been released. Of those, 54 have been established, so that's 83% of the insects that were tested and released established. But if you look at weed success, only 25% of those projects are considered to be successful. And so that's not to say that all of them fail, but of 36 species of weeds, we don't have enough people to handle all the projects. And so what happens is people start on one project and it gets dropped and not completed. Despite that, there's a long list, a respectable list, shall we say, of weeds that have been considered to be successfully controlled. The question marks are disputed ones where some people think it's controlled, but a lot of people think it's not controlled yet. But at least six species here of aquatic or wetland weeds, and then about 15 species of terrestrial weeds have been successfully controlled to some degree in North America. So let's look at one example here. Musk thistle, this is an invasive thistle from Europe. This is a photo of sort of before and after releasing these two species of weevils. And the interesting thing about these is that at the time that these were released, it was realized that they would also attack non-native species. So this Rhinocyclus chronicus develops inside the flower heads of this invasive plant, but it also attacks some native thistles. And so this is something that certainly is not acceptable today. It was acceptable at that time because of the philosophy, but native species are highly protected now. And so if something attacks a native species, it would never be approved today. And so in order to avoid that kind of thing, we have to try to prevent what we call direct non-target damage. And that's done by host specificity testing. Typically, we look both at no choice as well as choice experiments to go down a scale of specificity. And this is a system that hasn't changed very much over the years, but more recently there's been research on semiochemicals, looking at what odors are important for attracting the insects, because this is really the key for the specificity of the insects, is choosing the plant before they lay the egg. And at this meeting today, well, today and tomorrow, I think, Iktu Park and Vasu Kapli have given some presentations on olfactometers and semiochemicals. This may be an important area of research for the future. Another possible problem is what we call indirect damage. This is leaf beetle that has been released to control salt cedar. All these plants have been defoliated by this insect. But the problem here is that there is a native bird that originally nested in willow trees, but since the willow trees have been displaced by salt cedar, they now nest in salt cedar. So if you do that to salt cedar, what happens to the birds? Will the tamarisk defoliation affect these threatened and endangered species? And this is what we call indirect non-target damage. So the weevil is specific to the plant, that's not an issue, but are there other trophic interactions that are a problem? So how do we prevent that kind of thing? The main solution there is to make sure that we have agents that are highly effective and specific. So measuring potential impact has become a growing interest. And again, these are tested typically in the laboratory, looking at physiological impact on the plant, and then looking more specifically in the field for population interactions. How effective are they going to be to control the plant population? The permitting process, I'll skip this for lack of time, but simply say that there is a very direct, formal process of approving agents before they can be released. There are many different levels, mainly controlled by APHIS, but also by U.S. Fish and Wildlife. This has not changed very much over the years, except for the addition of consultation with Native American tribes in about the last 6 years. However, if we look at the rate of acceptance of permits, the blue line is for the United States, this took a dive around 2000. And so there's been a change in the application of the regulatory process, which is almost lethal for our field in terms of biological control of weeds. It's a serious problem. One of our recent review of the current status on that was made by Harriet Hunt and other scientists, published in 2014. And this is reviewing old projects which are considered to be widely successful by agents that are pretty well behaved. But looking back on them, we see that there are a number of problems with the agents that were released. And that if those agents were proposed today to be released, they would not be accepted to be released. So we have a situation here where we're currently having, if you will, regulations that are too strict for the kinds of agents that we realistically have been able to release in the past. In North America, we have very little data on the success, on the value of success of impact, but in Australia, there's been a very good review of their 36-week projects, and they reported an average benefit-to-cost ratio of 23 to 1. That is, for every $1 invested, there were $23 worth of benefit. One of the better documented examples in North America is by Eric Coombs and Peter McAvoy on tansy ragwort. And this is a rangeland plant. And this is a decrease in the ragwort as well as a decrease in death of cattle. So some of these are very well documented, but most of them are not. The other benefit besides economical benefit is ecological benefits. This is a tree from Australia that's invaded the Everglades. And two insects were released that have provided very effective control of this tree. And this is a graph of changes in species biodiversity. And most of these species coming in have been native plants. Not all of them are native, but most of them are native. So in other words, a biodiversity benefit, environmental benefits, which are very difficult to quantify in terms of dollars. Now, traditionally, biocontrol has focused, how much time is left?
3.5 minutes.
Okay. Traditionally, biological control of weeds has focused on things in the natural landscape, rangeland and aquatics, as you've seen, but could it be used in croplands? So if you have something like Palmer amaranth, which is developing resistance to herbicides, the natural solution is to try and find some other herbicide that will control it, because this is what the growers are used to seeing, bare soil. And biological control focuses on controlling one species at a time. So it's not a natural solution for a cropland environment. However, if your management system is producing just one species of plant, there may actually be a role there for biological control. But you need something that's going to operate within that kind of environment. Your typical weevils are probably not going to react fast enough for that kind of environment, but something like a pathogen or an aerophyte might. Very briefly, these are some of the techniques that are currently used for managing weeds in cropland systems. They're looking for a very fast solution. There are some examples, actually, of classical biological control of weeds that have been major problems in cropland systems. Not uniquely in cropland systems, but major problems. Here are two from Australia. Agents were actually released and successfully controlling xanthium. A silverleaf nightshade, there was never actually a release in Australia, but there was a release in South Africa to control this plant. That's what Nugurubora looks like. In this country, field bindweed might fall into this category. It's an invasive plant of rangelands and also of wheat where it tangles in combines that collect it. An aerified mite has been released that basically stunts the plant so that you get this kind of growth, which would be ideal in a cropland situation because it would prevent the problem of climbing onto wheat. I think I'll skip these for a European example. And this is rush skeleton weed and damage caused to flowers by an aerified mite and rust. So these are two examples of the kind of agent that might be very effective in a cropland situation. Both of them are dispersed by wind. I'll also add that we're benefiting greatly from genetic research. Typically now for all of our projects, we look at characterizing the target weed. In this case, rush skeleton weed has different genotypes indicated by colors here, and these have variable susceptibility to both the rust pathogen and the aerified mite. So knowing them is critical to getting success. Classical biological control, we usually use these to try and determine where to find the right plant in the area of origin so we can find the right pathogen or mite to control the weed of interest. Genetics is also helping us define new species of insects. This is a weevil that was considered to be a pest of many species of Brassicaceae, which include agronomic crops like cabbage. But genetic analysis showed that there was one population that was uniquely specific to an invasive plant. And so instead of being one species that attacks many species of plant, there is a population that's very broadly host-specific. Attacks many species of Brassicaceae, but the one in red here is the one that's specific to the invasive plant. So it's helping us to find and discover new species of insects. Likewise, this flea beetle was once thought to attack only musk thistle, but populations have been found that attack two other species of plant. And so in essence, we now have three biological control agents instead of one, just because of molecular genetics. 2 minutes, good. Lastly, we're moving into the area of grasses. It's always been thought that classical biological control would not be suitable for grasses, but John Goolsbee has led a program on biological control of giant reed, and two species of insects have already been approved for release, and he's already beginning to see some biomass reduction caused by this gall wasp. So given that we have a project that looks like it will be successful for Arundo, can we do this for other plants? And we have people like Brian Rector here and Renee Sforza that are looking for agents for Medusa Head right now. So, wrapping up, we have more tools that are giving us more capability to find agents. We have more restrictions because of access and benefit sharing internationally, but these seem to be getting solved one by one. The regulatory process within the United States currently is a bottleneck, which is a serious concern for the future. Cost-benefit always seems to be very advantageous, but we have very little data on that, and that's something that we need to focus more on the future, I think. And lastly, sustainability. This is a technology that's clearly very sustainable, and as we move more and more into the area of realizing that our agricultural system needs to be more sustainable, I think there's an increasing role for this. Stop there. So, yeah. We have 1 minute. A million seconds for questions.